You're listening to Crime Friction, a show about pants.
Where we put them on two legs at a time, just like everybody else. See, because that's wrong. Baby, crime is tough, and so is love. I'm sure all of you are aware that we lost Bill Kreider recently. We put out a call on social media for remembrances of a couple of minutes to be sent in. There was such an outpouring that we've decided to do a supplemental, shorter episode just for Bill. And if anyone still has some memories that they didn't get to send in, please do so that we can get that out as soon as possible. You can email them to us at crimefriction@gmail.com. And if you don't have a way to record, there's a wonderful app called Voice Recorder that's available for free, and that should be sufficient. And just record your memory and email it to us, and keep an eye on this feed for our supplement dedicated to Bill, which will be upcoming as soon as we can put all of that together.
I've been thinking about pop culture recently, pop culture and storytelling. I was going to say, well, you know, what's too much, but I don't even know at the moment if any of it works. I've been thinking, you can go back to Elmore Leonard, who I reference all the time, but he was well known for dropping in pop culture, and it worked, and it was a fun way of dropping some context to the story. It put the book in a certain place. But pop culture back then lasted longer. You know, a film would be in the cinema sometimes for 6 months or a year, and songs would be in the charts for a long time, and the pop culture of the moment just lasted, whereas now nothing lasts. It seems like a hit single is a hit single for 2 weeks, or a film is a hit for, you know, it's the opening weekend and then it's gone. And so dropping anything into a story now feels like it dates it too much. Like it's saying to the reader, this story doesn't matter anymore because it's gone, it's thrown away.
Well, that's really depressing and discouraging to those of us creating this culture, Jay. Thank you. Nothing really matters. I think I heard that in a song once. I absolutely see your point, because I have this argument with authors I work with all the time, and honestly in my own work, and I tend to be ridiculously one way. I do not provide, and I'm not saying this is the right way to do it. In fact, it's probably the wrong way to do it, but I provide as little description as humanly possible, generally about anything. If it doesn't inform the reader as to plot or character, then I'm probably not putting it in there. So unless it's, let's say, you know, Columbo drove that fabulous beat up car, that's important. That's part of his character, as was his, you know, beat up trench coat. This made up Columbo. These were symbols of him. But if it's just somebody who drives like a Toyota Tercel, that's really nothing that speaks to the character. You know, maybe a Rolls Royce would speak to the character to let somebody know that they had a lot of money. But beyond that, specifying just limits imagination, and it dates the work.
There's a few ways people throw this in. Like people might mention that a character looks like a certain film star. I just wonder if it's changed.
But I think there are things that are timeless, and that's fine. There are also words that are certainly descriptive of a thing without being specific. Like, you know, iPhones are probably going to be around for a while. You know, iPods, same deal. But like, if you had said Zune, now you've dated whatever it was you wrote. Going to your comment about Leonard, we talk about Justified a lot, justifiably. And
hey.
Yeah, thanks. And I think that with very limited tweaks, I mean, obviously they're driving cars from 2000, whatever it is, etc. They have cell phones, but it would not be hard to take that, set it in the same place with the same people, and make it the 50s, make it the 60s. There's nothing that show has a timeless nature to it that I think will last, and also encourages repeat reading, repeat watching, whereas other things are so of the time that until it becomes so far down the road, you know, you go back now and watch Taxi or the Mary Tyler Moore Show or something, you know, where it's been long enough that it circles back to being interesting.
I wonder if the nature of pop culture has changed so much for us now. I wonder if that's going to go away as well. Like, for instance, I can understand how, you know, stuff in the 90s wasn't really a good reference point for stories in the 90s, but then 20 years later it becomes one because it puts it in a time. But I just think that the culture and everything is so fast now. Are we ever going to reach a point when the current pop culture becomes interesting as nostalgia? Because it does, like for instance, people make Stranger Things, and it's set in an 80s that it's not set in a world that existed. It's set in a pop culture. It's referencing pop culture of the mid 80s, and if you like that kind of thing, it works very well. And
does it?
The pop culture of the 80s lasted long enough, you know, that you can make that, and you can say that I'm saying something about the pop culture that was around when I was a kid, for instance. But I just, do we, I'm going to sound like an old man now, but I'm usually on the other side of the fence talking about how great modern stuff is, but I just wonder if we move so fast now that there's never going to be a moment in 20 years time where someone says, oh, I'm going to make this film and I'm going to use that soundtrack because that's going to plant people in 2018, because I just don't know what 2018 is from a pop culture point of view.
I completely agree with you on that point. I mean, I think there were good things done referencing the 80s. I don't think Stranger Things was one of them. I mean, obviously that level of pop culture interests people because that 70s show was very popular for a while. And there's a bunch of other shows on right now that are set like the 80s, the 90s. But as far as what's going to be timeless from now, let's say from 2000 forward, I have no idea. Because this was the point that I was raising when I was talking to somebody referencing a celebrity in a book recently. Some people are timeless. Like, I could probably speak to somebody who's 80 and somebody who's 15, and they would both know who Marilyn Monroe is. The same would not be true of, let's say, Heather Locklear, Selena Gomez. But I think the thing is that we just don't generate that level of timelessness. And to really just go off on a tangent based on your tangent, Jay, Oscars in, I don't know, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, 30 years ago, people who would win a Best Actor, Best Actress Oscar would go on to then, you know, do more great things, maybe get another Best Actress Oscar, Best Actor Oscar, whatever it is. Meryl Streep being excluded from this conversation, it's amazing how in the last 15 years or so, the women who win Best Actress almost disappear once they've won that. It's almost a death knell to the career.
Yeah.
We don't have that timeless nature of much anymore.
I mean, to your point, Halle Berry won a Best Actress Oscar. You know, she hasn't, for whatever reason, and there might be, you know, other reasons involved with Halle or racism, whatever, I don't know. But just to stick to the actress point, I also wonder if there's just a, did we all as pop culture undermine that award? Because Marissa Tomei won it, and then within seconds of her winning it, everyone's talking about how she, it wasn't really her. The one thing that Moonlight, that whole fiasco, at least finally put to bed, was people's theories that Marissa Tomei was read out accidentally, because we know that there are people whose job it is to correct that. I don't know if this just because I was too young at the time, you know, and would have looked up to the movie stars in a way that maybe I don't, you know, as a grown-up, but there does seem to be, and I think it ties all the way back into the, you know, how fast we cycle through things at the moment, that
I agree.
As soon as someone's won the award, we're tearing them down and saying how they didn't deserve to win it. And I don't, my impression is we didn't do that in the past. And I, you know, older people, old folks.
You never met my father.
Right in. I think that ties right back to what you were saying about, you know, there's a certain age of film star that you can reference in a story and it means something. But then you lose that if you reference a more modern one.
Well, but I think that's true also. I mean, even if, let's say, buildings. I mean, it's very hard. Yes, there's some amazing architecture, like there are some amazing actresses. So, you know, please don't write in for this. But on the whole, we don't build things to last. Mm-hmm. In the 50s, they built movie stars to last. And architecture was built to last. You didn't build a home that would be torn down. You didn't build a mall that would be torn down. You didn't build an office building that would be torn down in 10 years. But that's kind of what they do now, with very few exceptions. something like the Petronas Towers or the Gherkin, which I think is only famous because it's so reviled generally, or Iron Pei's pyramid at the Louvre for the same reason. But name a building that you know of that's an iconic building that was built in the last 10 years, 20 years, that are not the ones that I just mentioned, which are known for being reviled.
Yeah, ones that kind of, they feel more like a publicity stunt than a lasting statement.
Chrysler Building, Empire State Building, Sears Tower, all of these things were built to last. They were built to be a great and grand thing. And I don't think we have that level of, I don't know if it's our attention span. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we just don't care. But everything is so impermanent.
There's something really nice I like about the history of the Empire State Building, the way that, I mean, that it happened, it was being built as New York, well, as America really, but, you know, specifically the city it was in as well, was broke, had absolutely no money, couldn't afford anything, as the Depression kicked in. But they kept on building it and they kept finding ways to build it because it was this idea that if we're building this big, impressive structure, then it's inspirational. It's something for people to literally look up to. And that just feels like it's just that difference of, that was a statement and that was meant to inspire. And we don't do that now.
No, we don't.
And I'd just like to say, I was looking back through, I was going to back up your point by looking at the list of famous actors who've won Oscars. But all I was doing as I was looking through the list was thinking, nope, sexual predator, nope, sexual predator, nope, sexual predator. So, just wanted to reference that. I guess now we pass over to Tom and Sam.
Hi, everybody. Once again, this is Todd Robinson.
And Sam Robinson.
who has a mouthful of hot pizza that he was not expecting. And this is Sam and Todd's Very Important Opinions, where we bring you our reviews of children's crime and mystery books. And this week, we're going to talk about...
The Bad Guys.
The Bad Guys by Aaron Blabby. Blabby? Blabby?
Blabby.
Blabby. Sam thinks it's Blabby. So we're going to go with that for now. It's hard with some of these names. So originally, when we discussed reviewing this book, Sam said, Daddy, I don't think this is a mystery book. And I said, it's not, but it is a crime book. And it is very, very funny. Who are the main characters, Sam?
Mr. Fox? Wait, Wolf and Fox.
Wolf. Mr. Wolf.
Mr. Snake. Mr. Shark. And Mr. Piranha Chico.
And Mr. Piranha Chico. Where's he from, Peru?
No.
He's Bolivia?
I think it's Bolivia.
He's from the Amazon. Either way, he's a piranha. So, any adults reading this book, you will recognize Mr. Wolf, Mr. Shark, Mr. Piranha, and Mr. Snake, as they are all wearing black suits, white shirts, and black ties. And any aficionado of Quentin Tarantino will get that immediate reference and immediate joke. So, what did you think of the bad guys, Sam? He's still chewing his pizza. We're doing this on the fly during dinner time.
Because we're late for it. We're late for our review.
Well, we are. What did you think of this book, Sam?
It was 100% funny.
It was, I think, the funniest book we've read and reviewed so far. I know that I laughed a couple of times out loud. And essentially the story is you have these four characters who are historically known to be the bad guys. And Mr. Wolf comes up with a plan where they can finally be the good guys. And part of that involves a hilarious rescue of a kitten in a tree, kinda. And their big plan, which is a prison break. Where's that at, Sam?
Where's that at?
Who's at the dog pound? The dog pound. They're gonna break out all the dogs.
And you might recognize Mr. Wolf as the main guy, and you might see that a shark is a grandma. So then you might recognize the wolf as the big bad wolf.
Yes, it is their disguise. They dress the shark up as a lady in the classic Bugs Bunny sense. So how many books are there in this series, Sam? Four?
I think it's five.
There's five now. Well, we've only read the first one.
I think it's four or five.
Four or five. But we are very much looking forward to reading the rest of them. They're short books. They're quick reads. But they are immensely clever and immensely funny. So check them out. This has been Sam and Todd's Very Important Opinion. Now back to you guys.
Chicos.
So that was Sam and Todd. Thanks, Sam. And congratulations to Todd, I suppose, if we have to, who is way over in France as we record this. I say over, it's actually kind of down for me, but it's over for a lot of people listening. Where he's won the Libra New 2018 prize.
This week's guest is Left Coast Crime guest of honor, Naomi Hirahara. Born and raised in Southern California, she's the Edgar Award-winning author of the Moss Arai Mystery Series, featuring a Japanese-American gardener and atomic bomb survivor who solves crimes. The latest in the series, Hiroshima Boy, will be out on March 13th. She has also written the award-winning middle-grade book 1001 Cranes and a series featuring Ellie Rush, a 20-something LAPD bicycle cop. The first two in that series were published by Berkeley Prime Crime, but most recently the series continues as webisodes on Discover Nikkei. The address for that you can find in the show notes. A former editor of the largest Japanese-American newspaper in the U.S., she has also released a number of nonfiction works, and a number of her short stories have been included in various anthologies. So please join me in welcoming Naomi.
I think moderators really should be honored because they are putting in the work. And you know what was strange for me, because I'm from more of a journalistic background, so when I prepared to moderate those kind of panels, I always read everyone's work beforehand. Uh-huh. And then coming to Mystery Pen, it's more loosey-goosey, right? Everyone's busy anyway. Yeah. But many times people are not even, you know, the moderator might not even be didn't even bother to look at the website, you know, and yeah, that kind of thing.
Well, that's so true. And that's not a good moderator. But this, at the same time, like you said, you have a journalism background, so you have a different level of experience. I find if, for example, a fan moderates a panel and they go whole hog and spend, you know, 6 months out reading every book that every author has written back to back, well, then that panel is just going to be completely inside baseball about those books. You know, that panel's going to be, you know, for those of us in the audience who haven't read them or just coming to these, we want that, okay, you know, here's what it's about, but let's talk about the author. Mm-hmm. And they've done so much research that it bogs it down. Yeah. So, you know, but like I said, a journalist knows how to ask questions, how to formulate them, and how to illustrate ideas to an audience that they might not already have.
So. And I've been actually, as a moderator, I've been exposed to great books that I normally wouldn't pick up because it wasn't in my subgenre. And so that's kind of fun. And so a lot of times you could actually build camaraderie or make a new friend or, you know, through the whole panel process. So,
oh, I completely agree. Yeah, some of the most fun I have are on really good, you know, when you have that panel that clicks, you know, and It's hard to guess at those relationships and that level of comfort ahead of time, unless you already know the people on it. But, you know, there are those, either the panel really clicks well and there's the back and forth where you don't really even need the moderator as such, you know, it becomes just a discussion and everybody lends a voice to it, which are my favorite. And then you kind of have those kind of stodgy Q&A ones where it's like
everyone
really
goes down the
date.
Line, right? I'm going to start with you now with this question.
Yeah.
And if you're on the end, you don't. Everybody's already answered your answer, you know.
I moderated a panel in New Orleans, which was Cozy's. Judy got in touch and said, "We've got a panel here that you could moderate, but we don't. You know, it's not your thing." And she mentioned the Cozy panel, and then rather than saying, you know, God, no, I want nothing to do with Cozies, I said, well, we could make that the panel. Put me on the end as a hardboiled or noir guy, and I'm asking the people on the panel to talk to me about Cozies. And so we made that the panel, and I read at least one book of everybody who was on the panel, and they all they all got to talk, and we got to entertain the crowd because it's a show. People paid to be there. And I still hear back from people who were on that panel a couple of years later because they enjoyed the panel. Whereas you can be on some panels, you don't really remember the authors who were next to you 5 minutes after you've left the stage because it just hasn't worked.
It's the element of the unexpected, like surprise us a little, right?
And it really does bother me when every panel, when you go to a convention, is just very genre exclusive. You know, only traditional authors are on this panel. Only thriller authors are on the only noir. So how are you going to be exposed to something you may or may not like? And that's why I think shaking it up. And it all honestly really floors me that authors aren't for that, because most authors I know, or at least thought I know, are in writing because they get to research a new thing, experience a new life, do a new thing every time they sit in front of the computer. You know, you're living a million lives, learning about a bunch of things. So I would have assumed that they'd be the first to go, oh, I can't wait to moderate a panel that's outside of my genre. So I get to learn new things and put my two cents in, which is the other thing authors love to do, right? and get new readers. And then so many times when somebody goes, this isn't for me, I know, you know, nothing about this. And I'll go back with, well, you didn't write about that, but you actually were, let's say, a doctor. See, it's a medical panel.
Right,
you know,
right,
you were
right,
a doctor and forensic expert for 30 years. You don't want to be on that panel? I don't understand. So it does surprise me that people don't want to mix it up more. I think that Jay and I had a conversation, who was it with, where we talked about how people will explore outside of their preferred film genres. Like if you feel like being scared tonight, you'll watch a horror movie. If you feel like laughing, you've had a bad day, you'll watch a comedy. Readers are not that way as much. You know, readers read in their, you know, in their little subgenre. I only read. How many times do you have people tell you that? You know, I only read this. I only read that. And it's so very different from the way we experience so much other culture. It's like, who only listens to jazz? We explore.
You know what I heard that was interesting? Because I've also done like one middle grade book, but from children's authors saying that a lot of kids, they don't discriminate that way. You know, when you're young, you don't say, I just read. I mean, yeah, you have science fiction fanatics or whatever, but usually kids will just read anything. You know, and it's only as we get older. I don't know if it's like a lack of time where we feel I only have X amount of, you know, time for entertainment. So I just want to do things that I know that I'll like. You know, I don't know if it's that or what it is. But yeah, it seems like we limit ourselves more as we grow older, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of the when people kind of ask, and we'll all get this question, some variation on it. And people are asking, you know, why did you get into crime fiction? And I always stumble a bit because when I think back to when I did start reading crime more heavily, there was no conscious moment when I went, oh, now I'm going to read crime fiction. It was just I'm reading a bunch of stuff and I've latched onto some authors that I like. And then, there was never that moment when you think, oh, I'm now going to shut myself off to other things. But I grew up reading comics, so my comfort read often is comic books. And that's another thing when, aside from, we can call superheroes a genre, but aside from that, you know, you can read anything in comics. You can read crime or sci-fi or horror or whatever. So I think quite often I'm probably more restrictive. I probably read more crime novels than other kinds of novels. But then when I'm reading comics, read anything.
I love graphic novels. They're just so amazing. There's a lot of young people here in California who are, you know, artists, but storytellers. Yeah. And we had a recent book festival in Little Tokyo, and there were a couple graphic novelists there. And we had a short, brief reading, you know, so different people went up and read. But with the graphic novelists, they showed their comics, you know, and it was kind of like it was a PowerPoint, but it was almost like a little film.
Yeah.
It was so awesome. You know, it was so incredible. So, and it really captivated the audience. So too bad. We need more like mystery and noir graphic
novelist. There's quite a few out there, and I think it's becoming, and I'm really appreciative to be living in a time where this is happening. We absolutely have a resurgence of interest in these, you know, in graphic novels, and that is a storytelling medium as opposed to just a, you know, the kind of thing that you'd read when you were a kid and then forget about it. There were, and there are now again, some amazing storytellers in this field. And I'm happy. I'm trying to think, Jay, what's the one, Ed Brubaker, the name is escaping me.
What, Criminals?
Criminal. That's amazing. Christa Faust did Peep Show, Peepland.
Gary, right?
Yes, yeah. With Gary. So Krista and Gary's Peepland, so you can edit appropriately there. Don't get it wrong on air. And you know, these things are really becoming more popular.
The thing with comics is that when it comes to storytelling, really the rest of us are the new kids on the block. I mean, comic books are hieroglyphs. It's basically the oldest form of storytelling there is comic books. It's just that, you know, somewhere along the line, we started printing them on the page and putting superheroes in them. But that's how language started, was words and pictures together to tell a story. And then we've kind of forgot about that. And now the rest of us, well, not us, but, you know, the rest of us culturally kind of got snooty about it. Whereas the people who were doing comics were just sitting there thinking, well, you're all the guys who've turned up afterwards. We're the original storytellers. We're just doing what's been done on cave paintings for thousands of years.
Well, and it's a wonderful way to get people reading, you know, kids, teens, everything, and then
go
evolve.
To the library.
And then to evolve what they like, because there are graphic novels I love, there are graphic novels Jay loves, you know, and it's not like we're reading below our age standard. They evolve along with us. So it's something that you can really see a wide variety of and learn a lot about without going much farther than that.
Yeah,
I think in many people's mind, it's just limited to superheroes. And since now it is more fashionable, like the crossover of like comic books and movies, right? I've never been to a Comic-Con, but I've heard it's like a total madhouse and, you know, Hollywood has invaded. There's more like these more down-to-earth type things that are happening, you know, the more personal kind of comics or graphic novels that's out there. And I think, you know, I'm Japanese-American, and my brother was like a manga fiend, you know, a long time ago. Yeah, so I thought, you know, a lot of people ask, how come these characters have such big eyes, you know? And one reason why it was so, because on one panel, you know, with big eyes, you could show a lot of expression, you know, and that's why they have that kind of facial characteristic. Yeah. And what's interesting is a lot of that type of, they have different genres of comics in Japan. Like one is aimed for women, you know, very women specific. And some of those comics have turned into like really beautiful movies, you know? So I think that there's so much possibility for, you know, that kind of illustrated story. Yeah.
And it's funny that a lot of the countries that say people in America and Britain, when we look to other countries as being interesting or more culturally advanced or things like that, sometimes a lot of those countries are countries that love comics. France and Italy, you know, comics are huge there. Comics are a massive part of the culture there. And that's something else that, you know, in the UK and in America, we're kind of behind the curve on of looking at these countries as very culturally advanced, interesting places, while at the same time looking down on something that they think is brilliant.
For political protest, right?
Yeah.
I mean, France, that's like, comics are so important for that kind of expression.
Oh yeah, during the revolution and afterwards, that was the primary means of subversiveness. Honoré Daumier is famous for, is probably the most famous political cartoonist, you know, and everything, you know, Benson and all the rest of it, not only owe a great homage to him, but also also, you know, our honestly political cartoon light compared to some of the things that were done, you know, in that era. And to continue on, Jay's point was really good, because with France, you know, you have The Adventures of Tintin, which I don't know how many of us, you know, I mean, it's still a thing. They still make these movies. And I learned, of course, they're tremendously racist if you go back and look.
Some of them are incredibly racist.
But, you know, I learned French partially from those. And the, what were the other ones called? The Asterix and Obelisk? Yes. And you know, these things helped me learn another language. They, you know, these not only are the things that, you know, are of my childhood, but were extremely educational and probably led me along the path to appreciate things like Rue Breaker's Criminal now.
Well, comics taught me our language, because I couldn't read when I was a kid. I'm dyslexic, and I've gone on this hobby horse so many times that I'll keep it brief. But it was a real... We know it looking back why it was difficult, because we didn't know at the time I was dyslexic. We just knew that I couldn't read. Well, my parents knew. I didn't. I was a kid. What did I know? But it was comic books that got me reading, because they specifically teach you how to read. They've got some pictures and some words. They teach you the idea of narrative and movement. And the art of telling a story with comics is really more about creating the impression of what happens between the panels. It's specifically telling people, between these two lines, you do the work and you put in the action and you put in the motion and everything. And there's something about that that helps you learn movement and narrative that then lets you step up to the written word and helps you to learn to read. Without that, I don't think I'd be a writer without that. Okay, money stuff. This is a segue. Who do we have as the sponsor this week?
This week's sponsor is Brash Books. One of their latest, Dead Man's Badge by Robert E. Dunn, features career criminal Longview Moody. He's on the run from killers and assumes his dead twin brother's identity as the new chief of police of a Texas town terrorized by a Mexican drug cartel. To pull off that deadly deception, Longview desperately works to become the kind of cop and man that his brother was. But when the two lives he's living converge, he's forced to embrace the violence within him to get justice and vengeance. Joe Lansdale said of Dead Man's Badge, "It's terrific, lean and smart and very good. Check it out."
That sounds great. And now back to our guest.
I'm part of a team that's doing a film adaptation of my first book. You know, this is totally low budget. I didn't write the screenplay. A young screenwriter did, and I really like it, but it's very different. It's set in the 1960s. My protagonist is, instead of in his late 60s or older, he's in his 30s. Yeah, so I'm venturing in this weird world that I probably should have no business being in, but it's kind of fun. It's kind of stimulating.
Well, I think you're so brave. So many people are so rigid about their work. You know, so this is what I wrote. It must be exactly this, and aren't open to new interpretations, new visions. And this sounds like you're like, okay, this is still my work. They're doing a different take on it, and you're enjoying it as much as if it were exactly faithful to your adaptation.
You know, what I kind of like about it is it is so different. I'm like the temporary, I'm like the executive producer before they get legitimate people. But I got this book. Have you heard of this book, Chantel? My First Movie? It's essays.
Sure.
Yeah, like the Coen brothers, and they talk about Blood Simple. And it's really fun because you could, these established filmmakers today, they had no idea what they were doing with their first movie.
Yeah.
And it's so encouraging.
Well, and you know, another really good one that I always recommend to new, not only screenwriters, but just filmmakers in general, if you read some of Kevin Smith's early books, I mean, he really, and there was a lot of luck, whether or not you appreciate his movies, he did everything right, and there was still a lot of luck, and he's very, very honest, and also very encouraging. So I always recommend his books to new screenwriters.
I think, I mean, kind of what you're talking about of us, you know, thinking that they know what they're on about, and then we find out that they don't, you know, that they're just kind of figuring it out as they go. I think sometimes we're all guilty, particularly in writing, of, because we want to look like we know what we're doing, we want to look I think to readers and to editors and to, you know, prospective agents or whoever, we want to look like we know what we're doing. And so sometimes we create the impression that we know everything that we're doing. And the one thing I always want to say when new writers, I don't know why they ask me because I know nothing, but when people do ask me for advice, I always just want to explain to them, look, we're all scared. We're all making this up as we go along. We're all figuring out what we're doing.
I think that, and I've learned this the hard way, actually. I mean, between Hollywood and politics and law and now, honestly, I mean, writers are on the whole some of the best people, or at least the most interesting people to me. But, you know, you go in a room and it's the one who admits that they don't know. Mm-hmm. That's the one mm-hmm. you're going to learn from.
Yeah.
Because mm-hmm. the person, and this is true of anything, whether or not you're a director yeah. or a writer, it's, you know, honestly, I stop reading the books of writers who stop learning. You know, yeah. if they think they've hit it and they're done and they've, you know, they've done the best that they can do and they don't want to try anything new, do anything different, I'm going to be bored there. Right. You know, I want the person who's always growing and better. And I think it was Reed in our first podcast. He's like, your next book should always be the best one. He's like, I can't even think of reading my first book. And there are so many people who are like, oh, my first book is the best book. And I go, who are you? And mm-hmm. what's your success model? You know, that's not what any career should aspire to. Mm-hmm. And the person who's published one book and then, you know, I think it's wonderful to inspire and mentor new generations of writers or creative artists in any way, because we can all use all the help we can get. But the one who goes, I did this once and now I know everything about it. Mm-hmm. That's the one who actually hurts the generation below. Because then they're going to make the same mistakes and stop growing and not explore because they believe they have a mentor or, you know, a process to follow and achieve.
Well, the whole industry and the whole world is changing too. So you can't stay still, right?
Right. And right. so just exploring yeah. everything and not being the person who walks in and goes, you know what? I'm going to fix this genre because I can do that and do it better. Mm-hmm. You know, that person's mm-hmm. never going to have success.
I think that the more, well, maybe not the more, but the louder the opinions a person has on publishing industry, the less experience they have in it. You know, the mm-hmm. more they're talking about what they're going to fix, the more you can look at that person and think, you haven't actually done anything yet.
Tell me more about the movie. Did you consider at any point doing Netflix or, you know, a series instead of a standalone film? I mean, you certainly have the material for it.
You know, that's what a lot of people said to me, but nobody really approached me about doing it for that media, you know, for the streaming services. And the director, he really wanted it more for the festival circuit. But do you think that we're kind of now getting too much content in terms of streaming? I've been binge watching my share, but now I'm kind of getting a little bit tired. What do you think? You think it's going to continue?
I do, because the thing is, I mean, you're not only priced out of the market, but we're lazy as a culture. I mean, I don't want to put on pants, Naomi. I don't know what your like life goal is, but if I don't have to put on pants, I'm happy. And so if somebody's like, I mean, that's why they keep upping the theater experience. You know, do you remember when you'd just go and it was just like a really hard seat and you'd sit there and then you'd leave?
Yeah.
And there you had yeah. popcorn or maybe a really old hot dog. And these were your choices.
Right.
And now it's like a dining experience. And, you know, if you pay $70, you get a blanket. And it's like, I have a blanket at home and some really cute dogs that I can snuggle with, whatever food I want. And I'm paying, what, like $7, $9 a month for access to all of these things.
Right.
Which, if there was an article today about that sci-fi movie with Natalie Portman. Thank you. It went directly to one of the streaming services. And they said, you know, it's not that everybody's complaining. The big studios, well, they're losing money really hand over fist, but they're also mm-hmm. only producing one of two things, like the major superhero movies or reboots of things that were tried and true before, because they're so scared of trying the new things. And so everybody's going, there's no new content out there. Well, there is. And guess where it is? You know, all that new, clever, unique voice that you want to see are now on all these streaming services next to that big blockbuster thing.
Annihilation's a really good, well, it kind of ties everything that we've talked about to this point, because it's a book adaptation. It was made. Mm-hmm. They set out and they made it. They had, you know, all the various the three or four different companies backing it that you need now to get a film made. They filmed it, and then one of the most important backers, I think, lost money on Geostorm and the Terminator reboot, a bunch of films that had underperformed. And so they watched the cut of the film and said, this is too ambitious, it's too interesting, we need to change this. And then the director said, no, we're not changing it. And the producer of the film took the director's side, and so that's why I think it's screening theatrically in America.
Yeah, it's limited
China,
release.
And then
yeah.
The rest of the world. So over here, it's going to be Netflix. And the Netflix mm-hmm. deal has come about because the financial backers were too scared to make a loss. So they thought, well, we can break even if we sell it to Netflix.
I think in terms of this project, it's called The Big Bocce. That's the title. Mm-hmm. It's so idiosyncratic. I mean, although there's like these unusual projects on Netflix and these other streaming, I think there still hasn't been enough movement for certain people of color. You know, they have more black shows now than they used to, but other, you know, it's still not quite totally accepted unless it's from the home country of Asia, you know, unless it's straight from Japan or straight from China and you have subtitles. But the whole thing of a minority group in America, it's still, I don't see the same kind of openness and acceptance. So I think we kind of have to do this grassroots. But I'm telling you, this whole salesmanship, I mean, it's a different skill. I mean, we do have to sell our books, so in that sense, we're salespeople. But for a movie, it's heightened so much. And I'm definitely out of my comfort zone, but you know, I just figure, like, it's not bad to understand different ways of storytelling, you know, fortunately or unfortunately, the business side is very much part of the film industry. So
I think it is for all of us. I mean, it's novelists, we're in show business. We don't always think of it that way, but we're in it. It's a different branch of it. And so we need to take both parts of that phrase seriously. You know, we need to take the craft of putting on the show seriously, but also it's on us if we want to be successful to learn the business. Another interesting point, I think, the idea that we're in an age when we're embracing the concept of stories from and about people of color much more. I mean, you know, Black Panther's mm-hmm. exploding at the moment, but that the phrase people of color, person of color, I think in pop culture at the moment, it still means very specific groups. We're kind of still narrowing it down a bit too much.
Well, I think there's tokenism to some extent. It's like, well, I put that in, so we're covered, you know, or that person's in that, so we're covered. I guess people, like, I'm friends with some activists, and they you know, like to protest the studios and go that route. You know, I'm not an act. I mean, I'm a writer, I'm a creator. So I feel the way I can fight the system is to create, and I'm going to keep pushing, you know, and helping other people push as well. Because if we don't have the content, if we just complain, but there's nothing out there that we're producing, then, you know, it's not really helping us too. So I think the onus is on both the people in power, but also the creators as well. So how did you get involved with VoucherCon, Jay?
Stupidity. I've been telling
you going to take that out?
No, that's the honest answer. That is the honest answer. I've been turning up for, I think, 5 years now. I'd rather, if I'm going to turn up to these things and have opinions and voice them, I think it's better to turn up and actually try and make a change than to stand and tell other people what they should change.
Well, it's encouraging to me that I see you and other, you know, younger mystery authors, you know, attending. And I'm starting to see, you know, even if it's just socially, you see, you know, younger people coming and hanging out. It's a good sign.
What do you have upcoming, other than your wonderful guest of honor at Left Coast Crime, which you can still talk about? Anything upcoming you want to promo, or something that just came out you want to promo, or anything about yourself you want to throw out there?
Actually, my final Masa Arai mystery is Hiroshima Boy, and it's coming out actually next week. So there'll be plenty of those books during Left Coast Crime. And so I'm going to be on a little mini tour, mostly in California, I guess, to promote that book. I also write nonfiction, so a nonfiction book that I co-wrote with a friend for, it's a small press in California called Heyday Books, and they do a lot of books about the region. It's called Life After Manzanar. So that's coming out in April.
Today about getting people involved, young people, old people, any people, so that these wonderful conventions keep going, and new blood is always welcome and appreciated. And I know that Left Coast Crime is open to any fan, any volunteer, any author putting in a bid for a future Left Coast Crime. Jay, what about BoucherCon?
Yeah, BoucherCon is open to anyone who wants to submit a bid. I wrote an article for The Thrill Begins just a few weeks ago. That talks a little bit about how you can bid and what the first steps are. The link to that will be in the show notes. Deadlines for bids that would be voted on at this year's BoucherCon is about to pass, but that doesn't mean you can't bid for future BoucherCons. You can't start to get involved now and think about putting in a bid next year. So check out the link and get involved.
If you would like to contact us for no obvious reason,
not at all.
If you're just bored, you're lonely, it's like 3 a.m.
If you want to be ignored by us by email, how can you do that?
Our email address is crimefriction@gmail.com. And what about our Twitter, Jay? If anyone wanted to interact with us there for God knows why.
If you want to tweet us, you can do it at DefectivesPod.
Perfect.
You can't contact us on Vero because we're not doing it.
But Grindr.
Oh, it's 8 o'clock.
The anticipation for that.